Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Most of us are generally satisfied with the idea of living in a market-driven capitalist economy. When we debate, our political discourse about that system typically revolves around the question of how much we should seek to regulate that economy, what rules we should put in place to ensure that the market operates fairly for everyone it touches, consumers and producers, individuals and corporations, Wall Street and Main Street. Some seek more regulation than we have to ensure fairness. Others seek less regulation to ensure a free market operating unfettered by rules. Geographer, historian, and theorist David Harvey holds a slightly different view. He takes issue with the idea that a capitalist society can effectively regulate itself and operate ethically, and he points to the economic crisis of recent years as evidence of that. Today on the program, we'll hear David Harvey's views on global capitalism and what he sees as the intersection between economics and geography. David Harvey is routinely among the most cited academic geographers and authors in the humanities. He's written many books and essays and has taught at Oxford and Johns Hopkins, among other prominent academic institutions. Currently, he's a professor of anthropology and geography at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His most recent book is Rebel Cities, From the Right to the City to the Urban Revolution. He's on the U of I campus to give a lecture tonight, hosted by the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. David Harvey, welcome to Focus.
Well, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. And as we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments for our guest at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. Let's start with that sort of big picture question of whether we can seek fairness in modern capitalism. Can we?
You can always seek it, but the big question is, will you ever find it?
Right.
And the answer to that is, there's a veneer of fairness within the market system which conceals a deep unfairness.
And what is that deep unfairness in your view?
Well, the easiest way to look at it, one of my favorite sayings is there's nothing more unequal than the equal treatment of unequals. So if you enter the market with unequal endowments, then pretty soon what you find is that the rich grow far richer and the poor grow far poorer. So that a market system has a habit of redistributing wealth from the masses to a very small group at the top, even though it's inherently fair in the sense that there's no cheating in the system. It's just that if I enter and I have resources and you don't, I'm in a position to dominate the trade, if you like.
But there really isn't any way, is there, I forget theoretical on a practical level, to start everyone at the same amount.
That's the problem. You're never going to start with the same amount. And so you have this fair system that actually ends up with creating unfairness. And so one of the things you have to do is, even though you have a system that looks fair, is you have to take measures to make sure that the unfairness does not build up over time. So, well, I mean, for example, over the last 30 or 40 years, we've been told that we should have a more competitive society, the market system should make the decisions, and everybody will be better off. But that you look at the measures of inequality as they were in 1970, and you look at the measures of inequality today, and you see that inequality has increased immensely in our society and any society that's taken the free market route. And this is a predictable result of going down the fair market kind of path of policy and saying let the market make the decisions for us and then everything will be all right for everybody. The answer is no, it has not been all right for everybody. It's ended up with the wealthy becoming very, very wealthy and the mass of the population having less and less.
So then what, in your view, is the solution to that?
Well, one of the solutions is, of course, public policies which redistribute from the market in certain ways, which actually perpetually negate, if you like, this tendency to produce unfairness out of what is actually seems like to be a fair system.
Well, it seems like that's sort of a different view from, I guess, the traditional view that a lot of people have in terms of what regulation is supposed to do. There's regulation that is designed to ensure fairness in terms of, from this point forward, everyone's subject to the same rules, and certain transactions, you can do it this way or you can do it that way, but not this way or that, not that way. And then what you're suggesting would maybe be something beyond that, which is no, regulations or rules that say, let's make sure that if the rich have gotten richer, that we not only continue down that path, but actually sort of reverse it.
Well, you know, I'm not a great fan of state regulation. I mean, because a lot of state regulation actually ends up making things worse. So you shouldn't put me in the camp of somehow or other it's state versus market. I think that's a wrong way to think of it. If we're faced with that choice, it's an awful choice. I think both of them are not going to work very well, because we know that the state tends to be dominated by big money, power, and so much of the stuff that goes on, redistribution through the state, ends up also benefiting the very wealthy. I'm in favor of saying, well, maybe we should try to get forms of social organization which are not subject to the market logic in the same kind of way. For example, building cooperatives, building worker cooperatives, alternative forms of social organization in which people get together on a neighborhood basis and try to organize their housing on a collective kind of basis, those sorts of things, so that you end up with land trusts, and you can end up with other ways of delivering housing than through the market. So I would like to see us explore many of those things which are outside of the market, which actually deliver goods to people in a different kind of way. And I can give you some specific examples. There's a cooperative in Europe which has existed since about the 1950s, and it started in fascist Spain in 1957. It's called Mondragon. Now, Mondragon set up a cooperative form of organization, and everybody in the cooperative is a shareholder. There's no, you know, boss, and no, it's, mm-hmm. and it's collective decision making. Mondragon now has something like 200 enterprises part of it. Now, one of the rules which is internal to Mondragon is that the remuneration within Mondragon is no more than 1-3. Okay, that the richest person only makes the wealthiest person makes only 3 times as much as the least paid person. So, if you like, the distribution of wealth is on a 1-3 basis. What's the distribution of wealth in a typical American corporation now? It's 1-600 or something like that. So Mondragon actually has a form of internal regulation in which people say, look, we all are making this enterprise work, and we're doing it in a collaborative way. We make collective decisions about how we're going to do things and who's going to do what. And at the same time, the remuneration that comes from the work is divided in this fairly egalitarian way. And you think what the world would be like if all of the corporations in the world were organized on the Mondragon principle, you know, where, you know, if universities, for example, were organized on a 1-3 kind of basis, what kind of world we would be living in if we were living in that world where we are collaborating and cooperating with each other, but we're not in the market in the same kind of way as many corporations are, and we're not, you know, also part of the state apparatus, and we don't want the state apparatus interfering. So I'm in favor of the development of those forms of organization.
And there are a lot of economists out there that would say, though, that would limit the ability of some, you know, there are some businesses, some corporations for whom, if you set those kinds of limits, it could set limits on their ability to conduct business effectively, that they could have a more dramatic impact on the economy for everyone within the system.
It's interesting. Mondragon started with one enterprise and now has 200, and it's expanding at a very rapid rate right throughout Europe. You know, so it's doing very well. And actually, there you are in Spain, which is in a catastrophic kind of economic situation right now, and Mondragon is doing fine. And so it actually is protected against, you know, all of these kinds of ups and downs of the economy by its form of organization.
How does it stay outside of economic systems?
Well, it doesn't stay outside, but it's got all these buffers. For example, Mondragon doesn't simply operate in the workplace. It also has retail stores. Okay, so it's always got market outlets. It's also got its own credit union, so it's got access to finance. So if members in the co-op get into difficulty, they can always, you know, borrow money from the credit union or something of that kind. So it's kind of internalized a lot of these issues. Whereas in Spain right now, if you want to borrow money because you're in trouble and you go to a bank, the bank won't lend it to you. Whereas Mondragon has its own credit structures and it can do those things. So I think this is the sort of form of organization that is an alternative to what we typically think of as classic capitalist forms of organization. And you imagine a whole city organized along these lines and what that it would be like living in a city where the distribution of income was such that it was on the basis of 1 to 3. For example, in New York City, you know, where I'm from, the top 1% of the income tax in 2008, the top 1% earned on average $3.57 million a year, okay? Half of the population of New York City is trying to get by on $30,000 a year. It's one of the most unequal cities in the world. And we see that, for instance, in the impacts of Sandy, you know. I mean, are you seeing rich people, you know, sort of with their assets destroyed? No, you're seeing maybe those people who are trying to get by on $30,000 a year, the ones are mainly hit. So the inequality in New York City is horrendous when you look at it. I mean, $3.57 million versus $30,000. And you kind of say, this is a crazy world we're living in when you have those levels of inequality. And so if everything in New York City was organized as a sort of Mondragon, it would be 1 to 3. And the whole city would look very different from what it looks, and urban life would be very different from what it is, and we wouldn't have the concentrations of near poverty of people living in marginal areas and then being, of course, extremely vulnerable to the sorts of things that they got hit with on Staten Island and in other parts of the city.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Our guest is geographer, historian, and theorist David Harvey. He's a professor of anthropology and geography at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His most recent book is Rebel Cities, From the Right of the City to the Urban Revolution. He's on the U of I campus to give a lecture tonight hosted by the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. We welcome your questions and comments for our guest at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. So, what in your mind has led to this sense that you have of economic inequality, maybe here in the United States in particular, over the last few decades?
I think there was a concerted effort back in the early 1970s by the large corporations to try to change the rules of the game. I mean, in the 1950s and 1960s, there was some sort of compromise. It was an awkward one, but that labor should get rather more in the way of you know, sort of both indirect income in terms of health care and the like, and pensions and things of that sort, and not bad incomes. But after the 1970s, we find this sort of attack upon union power, a systematic attack upon the standard of living of the working class, which was actually about trying to recapture as much income as possible for the upper 1% or the upper 2% or whatever it is. And you look back in the 1970s and you see forms of organization like the Business Round Table, which became a big, big sort of organization of all the large corporations, which started to actually change public policy in very direct ways. And they started to set up all of these foundations like the Heritage Foundation, the Manhattan Institute, and they started to actually propagandize at the same time as they started to actually then play a very important role through the political action committees in affecting, and they captured the Republican Party, and so we see the Republican Party then become a vehicle. So there was a political project which was set in motion. And it was backed by the idea of saying, well, we shouldn't have the state redistributing wealth from the rich to the middle income or to the poor. We should actually have a free market system in which people get their just desserts, and you therefore insist upon personal responsibility. And that then people have to be personally responsible for the education, health care, all those kinds of things. And so the state is going to be forced to withdraw, if you like, from that world of provision. And this is where Grover Norquist and all the anti-tax stuff starts to come in. And so we've been through 30 or 40 years of what I call of neoliberal politics, which is a particular ideology and a particular set of public policies and a particular approach to what the mass of the population shall have available to it. And I think that project has worked. To some degree, Democrats became connected to it. I mean, Bill Clinton was also part of the neoliberalization of the United States. So this politics has been going on worldwide for the last 30 or 40 years, and I think it's now run into these difficulties, which we saw 2007, 2008, that they couldn't square the circle, because if you cut the incomes of the mass of the population, then there's a big problem of where's your market. The answer to that was, well, we can generate the market by offering those populations for easy credit. So more and more easy credit went to more and more people. But eventually, the credit system blew up and we got the crisis of 2008, which we're now still living with.
Let's take a call. We have Ellie on the line from Champaign. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I have two points to make. First, regarding what you said about Sandy and the effects in New York. As a New Yorker, I'd like to say that that's not at all true from my own personal experience. For instance, I grew up on the Lower East Side and have lots of family there. The Lower East Side was tremendously affected by Sandy, and it was the middle class as well as so-called lower class that were equally affected by loss of power, loss of water, food problems, distribution problems, transportation problems. So, but let's even spread it out. Brooklyn and Queens, Breezy Point was not a lower class neighborhood. It was tremendously affected. Sheepshead Bay, Seagate, the Rockaways were not lower class neighborhoods. They were tremendously affected. Staten Island is not a lower class neighborhood, and they was tremendously affected. All of Lower Manhattan, which has large swaths of middle class and upper class, were tremendously affected by the Hurricane Sandy, and there was no income distributions that changed how you were affected and how you were damaged. So that's one point. But I'd like to make a, and then shift from that to a theoretical point. While I agree with you, income distribution and possibilities of attainment are tremendously affected by where you're born. So in a sense, you could say the capitalist system doesn't work well enough. But if I could paraphrase an old saying, except that it's better than any other system that has been tried, such as the Soviet Union, such as Communist China, such as the other Eastern European Communist blocs, which were an economic system which was, and I won't even touch the fascist ones, pre-World War II. So I'd like to hear your comments about that.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, first off, on your first point, I think it's true that some affluent groups were actually persuaded to live in condominiums which are along the waterfront, which was part of Bloomberg's policy, and they got flooded out. So yeah, there was a sort of impact of that kind. So it wasn't it totally connected to the low income populations, but almost invariably, what you find in these things when you document problems afterwards is that there are income disparities which are deeply, deeply involved in the impacts of so-called natural disasters. I mean, this is true of earthquakes and it's true of hurricane damage in general. You look at New Orleans or you look at, and I think you will find in the long run in New York City that the income disparities involved are very significant. The second point is, is there a better system anywhere else? Well, of course, there are varieties of capitalism. Some of them are more redistributive than others. I mean, you can take the Scandinavian model, which has, by the way, been doing extremely well through all of this crisis period and has been hardly the least affected. And, of course, it has a lot of income equality built into the kind of mechanisms. You would find even some surprising examples in places like Singapore, which is not one of my favorite kind of political forms of organization, but in terms of income distribution, with the exception, of course, of immigrant labor forces, who are treated in a very, very negative way. But in terms of the population of Singapore itself, you find something is much more egalitarian than you would find in this country. So this country is probably one of the worst countries from the standpoint of achieving any kind of egalitarianism. And when I kind of quote the income distribution figures in New York City, which you can get from the income tax returns, then what you see are levels of inequality, which I don't think most people in the United States, if they looked at that level of inequality, would say this is acceptable by any measure. I mean, most people in this country are in fact very, very interested in some sort of egalitarianism. And I think just looking at the income distribution figures these days, you just wonder how it is that those income distribution figures are maintained in the way they are, and why is it that they've become so phenomenally different now than they were, say, in 1970. And it's that transition that I think has been a political transition, which now has to be reversed or not necessarily reversed, but combated and displaced with something else, which is why I'm sort of saying, look, it's not about using state power in a different kind of way. It's really about finding alternative forms of organization that are not linked to this massive increase of inequalities, which you get through the implementation of free market policies.
We have an email from Ryan, and he says that you hit on something that he's been thinking about since the election. He says, as a society, should we label what the American dream is? Currently, he says, it seems to me that the American dream has morphed into a thought that achievement of that dream is great monetary wealth. He says, I, however, believe that middle-class living more defines the American dream, and he'd like to know if you have any response to that thought process.
Yeah, I think when capitalism really sort of got going, one of the things it did was that it took the view that the good society was one which was dedicated to the production of wealth. And to some degree, it displaced an idea which was around but not very well implemented, that a good society was dedicated to the production of good citizens. And you look at the United States and you imagine that somehow or other good citizens somehow or other emerge magically out of a society which is dedicated to the production of wealth and the accumulation of personal wealth. And I think actually that kind of notion of citizenship is very perverse, so that you look at the Wall Street bankers and all the rest of it and say, well, are these people acting as good citizens? And you look and you kind of say, well, they're not. I mean, they may in their personal life kind of give away a lot of their money, and some of them do, because I think they know that in their working lives they're not being good citizens. And then they try and turn around and be good citizens by giving it away, like Warren Buffett does or Bill Gates does.
Well, I guess in the end, though, doesn't it come down to your own definition of good citizen? I imagine some of those would say that the fact that I do give so much to charity demonstrates how I'm a good citizen.
Well, but it's trying to recoup. It's trying to give back what you've already taken away. So if for example, the asset losses that have occurred through the foreclosure crisis on housing has been huge, and they've been badly distributed. For example, I think Hispanic immigrants and African-American populations have lost around 60% of their asset value since around 2007 or so. They've lost all of that. And you kind of say, well, where did all of that wealth go? And then you look at the all of the money that went into the Wall Street bonuses, and you actually, it's interesting, about the amount that was lost in those communities is roughly equivalent to the Wall Street bonuses. Now, I can't show that money went from there to there, but when there's a loss of that amount in this population and again on this population. So this seems to me to be part of what the nature of the problem is under capitalism, that you get these redistributive kind of channels which are worked out through the market system in such a way. And then the wealthy on Wall Street, well, some of them give the money back, some of them don't. And it's up to them if they do or they don't. And I don't think that's right. I don't think they should have had that amount of wealth to give away in the first place.
And yet, and just to play devil's advocate on this, I could imagine there are plenty who would argue what you define as a problem is not a problem. That in the end, our economic system is based on this sort of survival of the fittest mentality. And what's wrong with the idea of someone, if they have found a way in a particular walk of life or a particular approach to make more money than someone else, well, that's the way the system works.
Yeah, except the system is self-replicating, so that those people who get all of that money, what do they spend it on? Well, we've seen what they spent it on in the last election. Okay, I mean, what did the Koch brothers spend it on? What are all these super PACs doing? What did Karl Rove's organization spend their money on? Well, what they spent their money on was trying to perpetuate political power, which was going to be advantageous to them. So if they just took the money they got and then they went off and they gave it away in sort of Robin Hood tactics, and there is a Robin Hood organization in New York City that does this, I think that's fine, you know. But on the other hand, they don't do it that way. They actually use their money power to buy politics and effectively buy the media and buy influence and essentially become monopolizers, if you like, of knowledge production. They're even buying universities right now by sort of funding great things, but saying essentially what should be taught and what should not be taught. So if they simply kind of just gave it away and asked no questions, that would be one thing, but they don't. Actually, the money is being used to control many aspects of our life. And I think what was so significant in some ways about this last election was that all of that money they had didn't actually make it. And I think that social organization on the ground did make it. And I think that's one of the lessons that's going to have to come out of this election. But nevertheless, you see what they spent their money on. They spent their money on trying to buy political power, and to some degree, they still continue to do that because they have a great deal of influence both within the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. In some ways, I look at Congress and I say this is the party of Wall Street in action. It's just two factions of Wall Street sort of battling each other in Congress, and it's not really about representing the people. It's representing big money power.
Let's take another call. We have David on the line from Urbana. Hi, David.
Yes. May I comment on the previous caller who paraphrased, I believe, Churchill, that democracy may not be perfect, but it's the best system that has been devised. Of course, he was applying it to capitalism, which is not entirely equivalent to democracy.
Right.
He then went out and pointed out to such systems as fascism and the Soviet pseudo-communism and a few others, the Chinese and so on. I would point out that there's very little Marxism to the Soviet system. It was really a continuation of the economics of the Middle Ages, it had little, if anything, to do with Marxism. But he neglected to mention a number of other systems that are more pertinent. For instance, the socialism, utilitarian socialism of the Nordic countries, or the system we had in this country in the 50s and 60s, which produced far more productivity and a much more equitable distribution of wealth. And, of course, the Scandinavian Nordic countries have a very productive system, although it's less socialist today than it had been. My question with this is, does it seem to you that what capitalism in this country is heading toward is a system of hereditary aristocracy? Mobility seems to me to be very difficult in the present economy.
Yeah, it's basically headed towards a sort of inherited plutocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's going that way globally. I mean, I was fascinated the other day. I think about 4 years ago in India, there were something like 25 billionaires, and now there are something like 70 billionaires in India. I mean, the sort of concentrations of global wealth are now becoming very, very skewed. And it's kind of interesting. Somebody asked me the other day, where's the city which has the most billionaires in the world? And it was kind of interesting. And I thought about it and I thought, well, it's somewhere surprising, like Mexico City. Well, it's not Mexico City, though that's pretty close. The place where the most billionaires in the world is Moscow. Actually, and this has all been produced in the last 15-20 years. All right, and the same is true about Mexico. So, globally, you've got the emergence of this plutocratic kind of strata.
In a way, is that not all that surprising if you think about any country that's been under a system like the Soviet Union had for 70 years, and then as they find themselves suddenly that system breaks down. And they enter what is designed to sort of be a more capitalist kind of, you know, at least the world economy to some degree. They'd sort of have maybe an extreme reaction to that. And so you would have the opposite place.
That may be true in the Soviet Union. But if you look at Mexico, for instance, it was the privatization which kicked in the 1980s, 1990s. Which allowed, for instance, the privatization of telecommunications, which allowed Carlos Slim to then become the richest person in the world. And so Mexico, you have it. India, you have the same sort of thing. So it's not simply that, okay, in the collapse of the Soviet Union, you've got billionaires. And, of course, you've got billionaires erupting all over China right now. So this global plutocracy is coming out from all sorts of reasons, but it's nevertheless a real global problem. And I agree with you entirely that there are sort of state redistributive systems. I mean, it's so interesting in this country. The top tax rate in 1945 in this country was 92%. The top tax rate in this country never fell below 70% until Ronald Reagan came along and reduced it to 30%. The growth rate in this country from 1945 until Ronald Reagan was around 4%. Since Ronald Reagan and the big tax cuts and all the rest of it, the growth rate in this country has been effectively rather miserable. It's around 3%, 2%. And right now it's not doing very well at all. So this mythology that somehow or other high tax rates on the upper classes do not allow strong growth is absolute nonsense. There's no historical evidence for it. And you could simply deal with all the debt crisis we've got right now simply by going back to the sort of tax ranges that were there in the 1950s and 1960s, and which everybody at the time accepted, by the way, and said, well, okay, I guess we've got to pay for the war and everything that happened in 1945. And so we get it out of our system in this kind of way. And you know, I'm not saying there were glorious days because there were all sorts of problems back then, but at least on that, there was some sense in terms of fiscal and monetary policy, whereas there's no sense in what's being sort of promoted today.
We're taking your questions and comments for geographer, historian, and theorist David Harvey. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll take more of your phone calls after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Soviets transformed Eastern Europe into totalitarian states after World War II. We talk with Anne Applebaum about her new book, Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, which is nominated for a National Book Award. Her book, Gulag, won a Pulitzer Prize. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 30th annual Arts and Craft Show on November 10th and 11th at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information is at 367-9546.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and our guest today is David Harvey. He's a geographer and historian and an economics theorist who has written and taught on those topics for decades. Currently, he's a professor of anthropology and geography at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's on the U of I campus to give a lecture tonight at 7:30 at Fullinger Auditorium as part of the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. That lecture is free and open to the public. To join our conversation this morning, call 333-9455 or 800-222-222. 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Elizabeth in Mattoon. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I really like this conversation because I hate to see what's happening in, out there with people. We can't even have a happy life, a life where we don't have to struggle. And now it's worse than ever before. And I'm 60 years old, 62 almost, and I've never seen anything so egregious as the way the government and those of wealth are just taking everything away from anyone. And what I'd like to ask, though, is if these co-ops that you suggest in your book are really good, and I think that's a good idea, how would you keep the governments from controlling and regulating it so it couldn't be possible for us to do something like that?
Yeah, this is a, you know, there are limitations on the co-op thing. I mean, if co-ops have to survive in competition with, say, standard capitalist enterprises, then this often means that they have to adopt some of the practices of this, of their rivals. So there's limitations on the possibility of just an individual co-op kind of managing to make it. There has to be, if you like, a growth of co-ops all over the place and a strong cooperative movement which starts to occupy, if you want to call it that, certain sectors of the economy. I think that cooperative housing, for example, is one area where this could happen. I mean, I would have liked to have seen a lot of the foreclosed housing sort of taken over by a municipality and turned into sort of some vast sort of cooperative structure in which people would have a security of tenure but not ownership rights, so that they couldn't speculate with the housing and they couldn't speculate on you know, housing prices and all the rest of it. So it needs some movement of that kind. And when you ask the question, how can you stop the government? Well, you know, the only way you can stop a government is to have a social movement which is strong enough to actually make the government back off. And, you know, we have seen social movements which have, I think, forced government to acknowledge the power. We saw it in the civil rights movement, and I think that if there was a mass movement towards the development of more cooperative enterprises and government was actually forced into a situation of supporting those movements towards cooperation rather than interfering and taking them over, then I think that would be the answer. But it has to be a sort of widespread acceptance in the population that the cooperative form is much better than the one we've got, and that by working cooperatively we can do much better than we see has been happening to people like yourself by what's been happening in the economy over the last 15, 20 years.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Paul in Champaign County. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if you would... Well, I still think there should be a counter to this idea that Sandy was some kind of egalitarian disaster. I mean, richer people in Manhattan, the boroughs, if they don't have a house in the Hampton, they know somebody that is, or they can take a hotel room for a number of days in the higher ground while they're negotiating with their insurers or something. You know, it's just in front of your face that it. Poor people are always taking the brunt of this. I just wanted to repeat that. But what the premise of my question was about these super rich counties that I've heard described by another author, and one of the ones that really bothers me, and I'm not an anti-government person, but the bloom of this national security state and the region in Virginia where these firms are based is just one of the really, really super rich counties in the country. I don't know whether...
Is this Fairfax County?
I believe so, yeah. FAIC is headquartered there now, and a lot of the firms are getting this largesse. So I don't know whether you have anything to say about that phenomenon. Obviously, Manhattan and the finance capital county is one of them, though... It breaks down on the number of poor people that are also there.
Yeah, it's really very interesting, you know, when people talk about dependence on government expenditures, and you actually, you know, and of course the right wing always is really talking about welfare cheats and all that sort of thing. But actually, if you look at the dependency on government expenditures, the sort of subcontracting that, for instance, the Defense Department has got into these days is absolutely astonishing in terms of the fact that private capital can feed at the public trough almost with no restraint, and of course, to the degree that they get located in areas like Fairfax or, you know, in areas in Texas or wherever, you know, you end up with these whole communities which are essentially government sponsored, but those aren't the things that people rail against. You know, there's some sort of imagery about you know, Romney's famous 47%, which is you know, sort of welfare cheats and loaders and all this kind of stuff. Nobody's looking at the degree to which government handouts are going to actually very affluent groups in the society and creating these, in a way, gated communities of super rich people with fantastic schools and great public facilities and all the rest of it, which contrasts radically with what's going on in the center of Washington, D.C. in terms of, you know, public education and social provision.
Let's see if we can get in a couple more calls before the hour is through. John is in Champaign. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. It's really great to hear you on the show today. I read one of your books several years ago in a grad course here at the university called The New Imperialism. And I was hoping you could bring the topic of war into the conversation, the idea that you discuss in there of accumulation by dispossession, and connect that same idea to the mortgage crisis and the role of the banks in creating the economic crisis to begin with. And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, yeah, part of my argument is over the last 30, 40 years is that actually capital has had a harder and harder time finding legitimate ways in which to accumulate. And so one of the ways in which it's done it is to go into this accumulation by dispossession, which is essentially a process of robbery, thievery, and all the rest of it. And I think the foreclosure crisis is a very good example of exactly that. And it wasn't only the foreclosure crisis, it was the whole sort of subprime credit racket, and it was a racket with these organizations actually making mega bucks out of the fees and all the rest of it, and actually engaging in daylight robbery of whole populations. And a lot of the wealth that was accumulated in the financial sector came from basically thievery and robbery of mass of the population. And it's astonishing to me to see that nothing has really been done about that. I mean, okay, a few court cases have been made, and there have been settlements by attorneys general, you know, against the Bank of America and other organizations, or Wells Fargo or whatever. But you know, basically, you know, people got away with fantastic cheating, and you know, and I was thinking about this the other day when you know, all this stuff about the way in which the banks decided what the standard interest rate was, the LIBOR rate. They fixed it in ways that were convenient to them. Now, if you fixed a football game, or you know, you would be drummed out of the business, and you'd never be allowed near a football field again if you were caught fixing something of that kind. But these people have fixed something far, far more important than a football game, and they're left scot-free. And this again is part of this dynamics of accumulation by dispossession, which really bothers me a lot and needs to be looked at very carefully, to say, you know, capital at one time or other actually made its wealth legitimately, or mainly legitimately. It's always had an illegitimate side, but increasingly over the last 20 or 30 years, it's become more and more illegitimate in what it's been doing.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to see if we can get in a couple of more calls.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to ask you to keep your responses and your questions relatively brief. Let's go to Michael in Urbana. Hi, Michael.
Morning. Just two things to comment upon. One being that the six heirs of Sam Walton have, between the six of them, an equivalent amount of wealth to the bottom 157 million others, which is, I think, an obvious obscenity. And that Thomas Jefferson was in favor of confiscatory taxation primarily because he had seen how the great concentration of wealth prior to the French Revolution had just skewed things so badly that he thought it would be a very good thing to prevent vast accumulations, especially in the heretical or form that you were talking about earlier. And last comment, the function of confiscatory taxation, which typically would have a lot of deductions and so on and so forth, is to prevent people from accumulating wealth, not to punish them, but to keep the money moving through the system rather than just ending up in a pile someplace and not doing anything except for the owner. Comment on that, please. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Any comments? Any reaction?
I think that's, you know, I've been playing around with the idea of could we invent a form of money which was couldn't be accumulated, you know, and it's very interesting because you need money to circulate commodities, but you know, could we create a form of money that would actually dissolve if you tried to accumulate it? I have this fantasy, you know, and it's a wonderful fantasy. And actually, there were forms of money being invented of this sort in the 1930s, and Keynes actually talks about it, which is stamped money. And it would say that if you had a $100 bill, if you wanted to renew it at the end of the month, you had to go in and pay $5 to renew your $100 bill. Oh. So it was an anti-accumulation tax. And I kind of think this is maybe we should have stamped currencies in the future. That would be great.
All right. Well, lots of different possibilities out there.
I'm half serious, yeah. You know, but you can see the point.
Yeah.
What would the Waltons do with all their megabucks? If at the end of every month they had to go into a bank and get them stamped in order to get the money renewed.
I'm already gripping my wallet more tightly as we talk. Right. All right. Let's go to Cindy outside St. Louis. Cindy, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. To me, it sounds like what you want to do is take away my freedom to decide how I want to use my money and put it in the hands of other people who make those decisions on how money and resources are used. And so who would make those decisions and how would those people be put in charge? And if it's a commune, you would still have a group of people deciding how to use other people's money and resources.
Yeah, this does it not, to some degree, fly in the face of the sense of individualism within our economic system?
Well, you know, the balance between individualism and collective action is always actually central to the way in which any kind of social system works. Other people do have indeed to make decisions. I fly airplanes around, and the air traffic control system is making decisions. It's making decisions for me, and I'm not actually in a situation where I can tell the air traffic controllers what I should do. And again, there's a lot of cooperation which occurs in the air traffic control system.
And yet, as an individual, I have the right, the opportunity to be more comfortable in first class versus coach.
Yes, you can.
You know,
you can,
there are choices that,
yes,
we still have control over.
Yes, but I think in any collective or form of organization, you look at how, for example, limited equity co-ops work, and there are choices which are being made, but people agree amongst themselves on certain basics. And then on other things, they're totally free to do whatever they want. And in some ways, this is how many organizations operate. I mean, this is how, for example, universities operate. I mean, we have a department and we have certain rules about things we can or cannot do. But within that, we're totally free to say what it is that we want to teach and how we want to teach it. So I think that balance is always there. And there's nothing about having a commune or a collective form of behavior that kind of says the individual can't do anything they want. In fact, some of the best ways in which you can do it is to have the freedom. It gives you more freedom if you have a security. The amount of freedom you have if you have no money these days is not exactly the kind of freedom that is very, very sustaining in terms of a decent life. So I think the balance you're talking about it's correct to sort of say, look, there are some limitations on freedom, but there are limitations on your freedom whether you like it or not. We have traffic lights, we have all those kinds of things. So, you know, you always have to obey by some kind of collective rules.
Wait a minute. There are traffic lights?
Yes, there are traffic lights, and we obey them. You know, we just don't kind of go and say, well, I'm an individual, it doesn't matter, I don't care, you know. I mean,
you haven't ridden in a car with me.
Yes. Okay, well, no, and I lived in Baltimore, where when the right light goes red, you speed up.
We have just a few moments left. What are you planning to talk about tonight during your lecture?
Well, I'm going to talk about the book, which is very much about what's gone on in housing markets, both in the United States and worldwide, and the relationship of what's been going on in urban changes over the years, and how important that's been in relationship to the generation of crises like 2007, 2008, and to what degree urban projects then become one of the ways in which people both get into crises but come out of crises, and what that means for the kind of urban lifestyle we live, and what kind of social movements are forming, which are talking about an alternative forms of organization around these more collective principles that I've been discussing today.
David Harvey is routinely among the most cited academic geographers and authors in the humanities. He's written a number of books and essays. He's taught at Oxford and Johns Hopkins, and he's currently a professor of anthropology and geography at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and his newest book is Rebel Cities, From the Right to the City to the Urban Revolution. He's on campus to give a lecture tonight at 7:30 at Fullinger Auditorium. It's hosted by the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities and is free and open to the public. There's a link to information on that lecture on our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus for more information. David Harvey, thanks so much for talking with us
today.
Well,
it's been my fun. I've had fun.
And on tomorrow's show, we will talk with musician and researcher Stephen Wade about his book, The Beautiful Music All Around Us, Field Recordings and the American Experience. Wade has appeared occasionally on All Things Considered with commentaries on folk songs and traditional tunes. And in his new book, he researches field recordings at the Library of Congress, which date back to the 1930s. And he's tracked down surviving performers and their families and fellow musicians to craft profiles of these long-forgotten performers and their music. We'll hear that music and talk about the process of trying to bring largely unheralded musicians of the past into the present. That's on tomorrow's program. We, of course, welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.